Okay, good morning. This is Bio 231 and it's Human Anatomy. It is Monday, September 22nd. And what year is it? 2008. That's right. And so I kind of mentioned that to you because these recordings I'm putting online for you to download and listen to. And there is a companion transcript, which is just a text file, but that's not from this class. Or it's from, I think, maybe 2007, I'm not really sure. So the dates don't correspond in the transcript compared to the audio lecture. The audio lecture is basically almost real time for you, but the transcript contains the same information, but the dates are all wrong and different. All right, so if you read the transcript, the dates of the test, even though the test is in September, sometime it just won't make sense, right? So what makes sense is what's on the audio version of the tape, not the Microsoft Word file, right? Okay, so we're pretty much right on schedule, believe it or not, in class. So we're going to start appendicular skeleton. What the heck is the appendicular skeleton? It means limbs, bones of the limbs, plus also the bones that attach the limbs to your axial skeleton, and those are what we call the girdles. So we're going to look at the pectoral girdle and pelvic girdle as well. But before we start that, who would maybe want to do a review real quick over axial skeleton? You want to do a review? No, not much? No? Not? Yeah? Oh, okay. Well, all right, so let's look at some bones. I'm going to show you some bones, and you got to tell me what their name is, and if you got a question about various parts, or if I think of something interesting about a particular bone, then we can stop and look. So what bone does that look like? Frontal bone. Should we just talk a little bit of neuroanatomy right at the moment? There, the lights are good now. So what lobe of the brain is associated with this front? That's a frontal lobe. You're not going to be tested on neuroanatomy on the next test, but it's good to review some of this stuff. Okay, so here we have a little rest station. What? Sphenoid. That should be really easy to see. Hopefully you've seen this before in lab, the disarticulated bone. And of course you got to know the parts, like what? The pterygoid processes, the greater wing, lesser wing, the body of the sphenoid. And I might say some things that are not officially on your list, and if it's not, then you don't need to know them for the practicum. Okay, because I don't have that list memorized, even though I made it up. I don't have it memorized. Oh, what does this look like here? Yeah, it's a foramen, and you should probably have a feeling for what kind of foramen that is, the name of it. That would be the? You know, I think that's the optic foramen right there. Okay, optic foramen. Okay. And this bone, ooh, that's a hard one. You might have to think about this one. That is the parietal bone. All right, what lobe of the brain is underneath this one? Yeah, the parietal lobe. And this one here, that's a temporal lobe, and the temporal lobe's got a bunch of nice parts to it. Like this region right here is the squamous region. This is the external acoustic meatus. And then, wow. Hopefully you can see it better than me. That's probably the mastoid process. Do you see a styloid process right here? I don't, but it should be there. Oh, probably because this is a real bone, and they just get eroded away in lab because we touch them all the time, and the acids in our fingers just kind of erode them away. But styloid process should be right here. And what process is this? The zygomatic process, right? We went over the nomenclature a bunch last time, but there were still a lot of students. I think I was looking in the class, had a lot of confused looks on their faces. Now, of course, this is the temporal bone, but we call this the zygomatic process because what is it articulating with? The zygomatic bone. So if we have the zygomatic bone, imagine that you have the zygomatic bone, which is what? Your cheekbone right here. It has a process that's articulating with the temporal bone. What would you call that process on the zygomatic bone? That's the temporal process, right? So we're going to use that same nomenclature all the time in naming processes and even depressions on bones. Did I see a question someplace? No? Okay. All right, so temporal bone. Mandible, and you got to know, there's a lot more pieces of this bone that you don't have to know, but make sure you know this is the only bone that, what, moves in the head. And you got to know this is what, the ramus and the body and the mental foramen and the condylar process and the condylar surface right here. Oh, what's this process right here? Yeah, and this, there's a hole right here. Yeah, mandibular foramen. So a lot of nice pieces on this bone. So if you're going into dental hygiene, well, you should have this thing completely memorized, right, and a nice picture in your mind when you're sleeping even. All right, here is a big bone with a big hole in it. Occipital bone, and we see the articulating condyles for articulating with C1, and this hole right here is the foramen magnum. Okay, and we got a little bone. Oh, you know, I wish I would have photographed these all to scale, but I'm not sure you would have even have seen this one if I put them all to scale. This is a really, really thin little bone. And that one is, it's actually making a little bit of the orbit, okay, posterior to the nasal bones. These are your lacrimal. That's a lacrimal bone. That's really, really thin. And on most of the skulls that we have in lab, as soon as you touch a lacrimal bone, your acids in your fingertip just dissolve it away. So most skeletons just have a hole where that lacrimal bone is because it's so thin. So be careful. Don't go poking your nose real hard in that area. And this one, my favorite bone, ethmoid. And I think we can see the crista galli and the cribriform plate with olfactory foramina in it. Okay. Question on this one, and if you hold it just the right way, it kind of looks like the letter E. Okay, because this bone sticking down right through here, that's the perpendicular plate that makes the superior part of your nasal septum. Okay? And what else is interesting about this bone right here? It has sinuses, paranasal sinuses filled with lymphatic tissue that helps fight infection, helps prevent you from getting colds and flus and things like that. And this one, not the scale, it's a little bit big, but at least you can see it. The L-shaped bone that makes up the nasal cavity is the, this is the, it fits in your skull like this, in the posterior part of your mouth. So this right here is the horizontal plate that makes the posterior part of your hard palate. This is the palatine bone, palatine. Okay, and then here's the lateral wall of the nasal cavity. What bone is this horizontal plate going to articulate with? The palatine process, right, of the maxilla. So again, we use that same nomenclature for naming processes on this bone. But this one right here we just call the perpendicular plate. All right, and this, oh sorry, way out of scale. Confusing the first time you see it, but that is your cheekbone. That's the zygomatic, and you can see the orbital plate right here of the zygomatic. And this one, another strange one. This is a standalone bone all by itself. It's kind of associated with the ethmoid bone in your nasal cavity. It forms a shelf, and it's the lowest shelf. Remember, you got three shelves. We call those conchae. So this is the inferior nasal conchae, and it's covered with a mucous membrane to humidify the air, temperature condition the air, and absorb particulates that are in air before they get into your lung. And this one, this is, again, not to scale, but I had to blow it up so that we could see it. It makes the bridge of your nose. That's the nasal bone, right? And here you can see this curvature right here for your nasal orifice, the opening of your nose right there. So that's a nasal bone. And that maxilla, do you have to know the name of this process here?
Yes.
Frontal process. Why do we call it the frontal process? Because it articulates with the prefrontal bone. Yeah, superior to it, right? Okay. So if you got some questions on how we name these different processes, make sure you come talk to me. I don't know how I can explain it any different. This one kind of looks like a plow that is used to make furrows in the ground for planting seeds. It has this little deviation right over here that forms a V. This makes the inferior part of your nasal septum. So this actually is your vomer. Okay, this part right here is very thin. And then this one, hyoid bone. Frontal bone. Okay, let's spend, took 10 minutes. Well, this next time through is not going to take 10 minutes. So let's just do it again, all right, for fun. So, what's that? Oh, I showed you that for way too long. That was a sphenoid. Parietal bone? Temporal bone? Yeah, don't blink. Mandible? See how easy that is? Occipital bone? Tiny, tiny, tiny little bone. Lacrimal bone? Ethmoid? That's the palatine, the L-shaped bones, palatine. That was a zygomatic bone, that's your cheekbone, kind of looks like a triangle, and that's actually pretty small as far as most bones of the head are concerned. That was a weird one. That's a shelf in your nasal cavity. Inferior nasal concha. And that's a nasal bone, the bridge of your nose. Maxilla. That's the vomer. It's a very thin bone that makes the inferior part of your nasal septum. Hyoid bone. Frontal bone. All right, so I think that's all the bones of the skull. So, all right, one more time, but this time we'll do it really fast. If you're not familiar with them, don't freak out, because I have this exercise online as a video, and you can play the video. Though I did have one email from a student that had a problem. I forget if it was the graphics part or the audio part. What part was it? It was a graphic. You could hear the audio, but not the graphics. You were able to do it? Good. Okay, maybe after class you could tell me if you can remember exactly what you did. Sometimes with computers you never know what you did right or wrong. But it's there, so you can just look at these. Ready? Sphenoid. Parietal. Temporal. Mandible. Occipital. Lacrimal. Ethmoid. Palatine. Zygomatic. Inferior nasal concha. All right, we're going to take a quick break. So that's the inferior. There are two more. Okay, there's a middle and a superior. How come I didn't show you those? Because they're part of the ethmoid. They're automatically part of the ethmoid. You don't have to be concerned about those. Okay? They're automatically in there with the ethmoid. All right, here we go again. Nasal. Maxilla. That's the vomer. Hyoid. Frontal. That's it. All right, so that's sort of going to be like most of your practicum coming up next week, except you got some ribs and some vertebrae, things like that. So I think you should feel real good. If you could just look at that slide for like a quarter of a second, you're probably going to be really bored during the practicum when you have to stand there a whole 60 seconds. Right? So you got more than plenty of time to do well on that practicum. Okay. All right, so let's move on to the appendicular skeleton, and I'm just going to start looking at some slides. Okay, so the axial skeleton, remember, are your appendages plus the girdles that attach the appendages to your axial skeleton. And what we see on this slide is just the most proximal end of the upper appendage, so this is the humerus right here. But we also see the two bones that make up the pectoral girdle, and that is the scapula and the clavicle right here. And you can see that the clavicle has a nice curvature to it. And that curvature is very important because these clavicles break routinely. The clavicle is wedged between your shoulder, right here, which is the head of the humerus, and the sternum. And remember, the sternum we looked at because that's part of the axial skeleton. All right, so the clavicle really doesn't move very much. So with even a moderate amount of trauma to the shoulder, since the clavicle or these joints don't move anywhere, guess what gives? The clavicle breaks. Okay, so it's common to have a break of a clavicle when you have trauma to your shoulder. But this curvature right here is very nice because there are some very important huge blood vessels that course into the arm, right? That would be called the subclavian artery. I looked at this for years and years and years, and I didn't realize how nicely that was named. Because here's the clavicle. What artery is underneath the clavicle? The subclavian. Probably some of you have known that for decades already. But what does sub mean? Below the clavicle, the subclavian artery. And of course, when a bone breaks, it lacerates a lot of tissue around it. And if you were to lacerate that blood vessel, oh, you'd probably maybe die in 10 or 15 minutes, something like that, right? Okay, but because of the shape of this clavicle right here, the clavicle always breaks in a certain direction. It doesn't break inward or downward to lacerate the subclavian. It breaks anteriorly and comes out to the surface, right? And that's just a nice evolutionary trick of this clavicle that helps explain the curvature a little bit. Okay, there's a sternal end and an acromial end. The sternal end kind of, we can't see it on this picture, but it kind of looks like the opening of a trumpet, right? It's very broad, no matter how you look at it. But the acromial end that articulates with the acromial process on the scapula right here is very thin. So it's broad in one dimension, but it's thin in the superior-inferior dimension. Looks more like a knife, not like the broad opening of a trumpet. So you got to make sure you know both of these ends, and you got to know this conoid tubercle right here and the acromial end. And here is the joint. What bone is this right here? Can't see it all. It's sternum, but you actually know a lot more already. What part of the sternum is that? That's the manubrium. So this is the clavicular-manubrial joint. Right, so this is a joint between the clavicle and the manubrium. And this right here is the only joint that's holding your whole upper appendage to your body. That's just that little teeny joint right there, which is a little surprising. Okay, so that's the joint, but what else is stabilizing your shoulder and stabilizing the scapula right here? That's going to be the topic when maybe the beginning of next week, and that is muscles. Muscles are really stabilizing the shoulder joint, not this little joint right here. Okay. All right, so that's the clavicle. The second bone that we have right here that forms the what? It's the, yeah, shoulder joint, but actually in terms of the skeletal system, okay, what is a scapula? It's a second bone of something that you should have in your mind. We call that that's a girdle, right? A pectoral girdle that's holding your upper appendage to your axial skeleton right at this one joint right here. So here is the scapula. And of course, when you look at this one in lab, well, there's a nice clavicle. All right, here's the scapula. Of course, when you look at this one in lab, make sure you pick it up and you turn it around all different kinds of ways and put it on your body the way it's supposed to fit, because there's a lot of different little angles and notches and ridges on this thing. And I don't want you to be confused in lab or in lecture. But it's actually pretty easy, because how do you know the lateral side of this bone? Because there is the big socket that's going to attach your humerus. All right, and we call that the glenoid cavity right here. Glenoid cavity. Sometimes we call that the glenoid fossa. That accepts the head of the humerus. So this is the lateral side. So this has got to be the medial side. All right, then the other thing that you should be aware of is the anterior and posterior part of this bone. The anterior part forms this big, shallow depression that we call the subscapular fossa. Right, so that's anterior, which is what? The front of your body. That's facing front. Facing posteriorly are going to be a couple other fossas with this big ridge between them that we call the scapular spine. So here is the supraspinous fossa, because here's the spine. Here is the infraspinous fossa. And what are the functions of all these fossa? Subscapular fossa. It is for holding something, right? And in particular, you probably don't know yet, but I'll just tell you, they hold muscles. Guess what the name of this muscle is? This muscle in the subscapular fossa is called the subscapularis, right? So if you do a really good job with bones, like I said before, it makes the rest of the course really easy, right? So I would go into lab and spend as much time as possible, or go over to the library and talk to tutors, go to SI, right, and just become familiar with these bones, because it will kind of like grease the rest of the class if you know these things. Guess what the name of the muscle is in the infraspinous fossa? That's the infraspinatus. And this muscle over here in the supraspinous fossa, that's the supraspinatus. Right? Okay. Well, We didn't want to talk a lot about muscle, but it's just too handy to pass it up. Okay, so what border is this on the scapula? Okay, you said medial border, but why? Forget that's there. How do you know that's the medial border? Because the glenoid, right, cavity or glenoid fossa is the lateral side. So the medial border is opposite the glenoid cavity right here. All right, attached on the, so what side of the scapula is this, medial or lateral? That's lateral. So on the lateral end of the spine, scapular spine, we have the acromion process. And then we have another process, all right, that's separated from the acromion. Again, you're going to have to look at these bones. That's the coracoid process. So there are muscles and ligaments, tendons and ligaments that are associated with the acromion and coracoid process that work across the shoulder to stabilize the shoulder joint. And here we see the subscapular notch. Sometimes it's not a very deep notch in the superior border of the scapula. And then we have the superior angle and inferior angle of the scapula. But don't be turned around by this guy. Manipulate it in lab and put it on your body and see how it fits, or go over to the skeleton and see how it fits on the skeleton. So this is good. There are two parts of this scapula that aren't labeled, that are labeled on the material that you have to know for lab. And it's too bad they left it out of this book. But there is a little tubercle right here. Who can tell me what a tubercle is? What's a tubercle? It's a rough raised area, so you should be able to feel it with your fingertip, even if you can't see with your eyes. It's a rough raised area. What's the function of a tubercle? It's a muscle attachment, right? Muscle attachment. Any kind of process, you're automatically going to say muscle attachment. So that's a muscle attachment. This, because it's below or inferior to the glenoid cavity, we call that the infraglenoid tubercle. That's going to be an important muscle attachment for, anybody know what this muscle is back here? That's the triceps. Okay, that's the triceps. And above the glenoid fossa, there's another tubercle. We don't call that the infraglenoid tubercle. We call that the supraglenoid tubercle. And that's for attachment for another important muscle, namely the biceps. Okay, so you should maybe get a little feel that the biceps and triceps are kind of opposite compartments of your arm. Therefore, they attach to opposite ends of the glenoid cavity. So we're gonna see some symmetry like that later on. All right, so don't forget about the infraglenoid, supraglenoid tubercle. And notice that this fossa right here, or cavity, is pretty shallow. It's not very deep. So that gives you an advantage, but also a disadvantage because of the depth of this socket right here for insertion of the head of the humerus. And because it's not very deep, okay, think of your shoulder joint compared to your hip joint. And if you're not a ballet dancer, okay, just you're a regular person, all right, which joint do you have more mobility with and dexterity and range of motion? The shoulder, because this glenoid cavity is very shallow. You have a lot more range of motion. So that's an advantage compared to your hip. But there's a trade-off. What does a trade-off mean? Trade-off means if you gain something by a certain kind of design or application, there's always what? Downside. There's a loss also associated with it. So what's the loss associated with the shoulder, or the glenohumeral joint? A lot of range of motion, but it is relatively weak compared to your hip joint. And we're going to look at the ascoxae in a little bit later. All right, so it's a lot easier to damage a shoulder joint than a hip, but that's a pretty good trade-off because you have a lot more dexterity at the shoulder joint. But there is something, and you'll have to check your book, there is a lip of connective tissue that extends from the bony structure of the glenoid cavity that functionally makes the cavity deeper. And the name of that connective tissue is called the labrum. I forgot it for a second, okay, but I just remembered. It's the labrum, the glenoid labrum. That might be in your book. And if you follow professional sports, guess what? There's a lot, especially pitchers, right, will damage that labrum right there, or maybe an outfielder that's throwing a baseball all the way from the outfield back to home plate. Okay, that labrum is soft tissue, and it can be damaged. But it helps stabilize the joint a little bit. But certainly it's not as strong as the bone in that area. All right, so this is a good picture where you can see the infraspinous fossa. So what, coming from this direction, what direction is this? What surface of the bone is this? Is this anterior or posterior? Okay, aha, I tricked you. It is difficult to see this bone. That's why you got to pick it up in lab and put it on yourself. This is actually the anterior part of the bone. And here is the posterior part. Here's a subscapular fossa. Oh, wait a second. Oh, no, no. Oh, I'm sorry. I tricked myself. I thought this was the spine. No, here's the spine. Here's the spine of the scapula. All right, so here's the infraspinous fossa, supraspinous fossa, and then the subscapular fossa. So you're right. So this is the anterior part here, and this is posterior. Okay. Oh, it says anterior posterior. Good. All right, so now we're done with the pelvic girdle, and we're going to look at the upper appendage. And so here is the proximal bone of the upper appendage. This is the humerus. And the humerus has got a head right here. This is the articular surface. What's covering this articular surface right here? Cartilage. Remember what kind of cartilage? It's called articular cartilage, but it also more, it's called hyaline cartilage, right? It's hyaline cartilage. So this surface, when you palpate it with your fingertips, should be what? That's like a big protuberance off of the bone, but it is a smooth surface for articulation, right? All right, so up over here we have the proximal epiphysis, and there is a narrowing between the head of the humerus and these tubercles right here. There's a little narrowing, and that narrowing is what we call the neck, but it's still very massive, and the humerus hardly ever fractures at this location, even though it is the true anatomical neck. Where the humerus has a tendency to break is where it is not so massive. And so we call this the surgical neck, because that has to be repaired surgically a lot of times. Okay, here are some tubercles, the greater tubercle, lesser tubercle. Guess what these are for? Muscle attachment. And we have an intertubercular groove, and part of the biceps, there's one part of the tendon of the biceps that goes through this groove, and it inserts into the scapula. Can anybody remember what that bony little prominence, rough raised area on the scapula was called? It was the, yeah, you could probably guess one or the other, and it's going to be the supraglenoid tubercle, right here, supraglenoid tubercle. So it's going to go over the head of the humerus right into the supraglenoid tubercle. Then we have the diaphysis of the humerus, a deltoid tuberosity. Oh, what? Guess what muscle attaches to the deltoid tuberosity? Even if you haven't taken anatomy class, you've probably heard of the deltoid muscle, because that's where you get those shots all the time, right? And this is where it inserts into the deltoid tuberosity. Now, the distal part of the humerus right here, has some fancy articulating surfaces. Now, how can, and this one right here is called the capitulum, and it looks very spherical in nature. The trochlea right here looks more like a bobbin that you wind thread up on, at least in my view. Now, how do you know which one is medial and which one is lateral? Is the capitulum medial or lateral? Okay, so try to get a picture in your mind, and you're correct. And if you look at the diagram, it's easy to tell, because the head of the humerus is going to be, obviously, where? It's going to be medial, because it's attaching to the glenoid fossa. All right, so the capitulum is lateral, and the trochlea is medial. So there are two articulating surfaces right here that gives you a hint as to how many bones are in the forearm. How many bones are in the forearm? You got two. You got a medial one and a lateral one. And the lateral one is what we call the radius. And so the head of the radius articulates with the capitulum, and the ulna articulates with the trochlea right here. So you got radius articulating here, trochlea here. So if you feel these surfaces of the capitulum and trochlea, how should they feel? Smooth, because they're for articulations. All right, so the capitulum and trochlea are special names, because the elbow is a special joint, for condyles. Remember, a condyle is a massive bony prominence for articulations. Sometimes we have bony prominences superior to or just inferior to a condyle, and we would call that an in this particular case, epicondyle, because it is above this condyle right here, which is what we call the trochlea. So the trochlea is medial, so that's the medial epicondyle. And then here is the lateral epicondyle superior to the capitulum. All right, so you got to know this capitulum and trochlea and what bones articulate with them. Best way to do that is in lab, put those all three of those bones together and see how they fit. I mean, it's just a very beautiful fit, and you can see how that happens. We have a couple of fossa on the anterior side of the humerus. Here is the radial fossa, a little depression. And when your arm is flexed, the radius comes up, and the head of the radius fits right into this fossa right here. So even though there's a little depression right here on the humerus, we call this the radial fossa, right? So this, because this articulates with the radius. So this is like what? The zygomatic arch, when you name the different parts of the zygomatic arch. Here is the coronoid fossa, because there is a big bony prominence on the ulna that fits into this fossa right here when your forearm is flexed. And guess what the name of that process is going to be called? The coronoid process on the ulna, it fits into the coronoid fossa of the humerus when your arm is flexed. But not only can you flex your forearm, you can what? Extend it. Right? There is a big bony prominence on the ulna, that's your elbow, right here, that you bang all the time, hopefully not too often. And that big bony prominence, when the arm is extended, has to fit into a fossa, and we call that the olecranon fossa, that's on the posterior side of the humerus. So guess what that, with that big bony prominence on the ulna is? If it fits into the olecranon fossa in the posterior humerus when you're extended, that's got to be the olecranon process of the ulna. All right, so that's the humerus. Make sure you know these articulations and all these nice little fossa right here. So now we're down in the forearm, and we see two bones in the forearm. The lateral one is the radius, and the medial one is the ulna. So guess what artery is lateral? That's the radial artery. Guess what artery is medial? That's the ulnar artery. All right, so again, that's really helpful. And so here is the radius. This is the one that's going to line up with your thumb. And here is the head of the radius. And you're going to see that there's a fossa for articulation with what part of the humerus? The head of the radius articulates with the capitulum. Okay. And also, if you look at the head of the radius, you're going to see that it's nice and round if you look down from the top, because this radius can actually pivot within, okay, or up against, next to the ulnar. So there is a nice radial fossa, okay, in the ulna right here that accepts the head of the radius. All right, so here's the head of the radius. Now, the head of the ulna is the distal part of the bone. It's on the distal epiphysis. So here is the head of the ulna. And notice, again, it kind of looks, what, very round? And that fits into a notch inside the radius, which we call the ulnar notch. So here's the ulnar notch over here in the radius, and here's the radial notch up over here, which is part of the ulna. Again, we're using that same kind of nomenclature that we use to describe the bones that make up the zygomatic arch. All right, we have a couple styloid processes on the distal epiphyses of both the radius and the ulna. And you can see a ligament between the radius and the ulna. And this ligament is sort of interesting because it allows for a lot of motion. As we're going to describe the motion in a little bit. So this is a ligament that doesn't just hold the forearm fixed in position, but allows you to what we call pronate and supinate your hand. We call that the interosseous membrane. And now here is what makes your elbow joint. This is the olecranon process. All right, and here is the coronoid process. Let's see if I got another view of these bones right here. Sort of helpful. Okay, so here we can see the trochlea, the thing that kind of looks like a bobbin, and here's the capitulum. The head of the radius articulates with the capitulum, and this indentation in the ulna right here is what we call the trochlear notch. So here we got the coronoid process. Inferior to that is the coronoid process and the trochlear notch between them. This trochlear notch is what fits right up against the trochlea of the humerus. Okay, so this is just forms a really nice hinge joint that allows you to flex and extend. All right, so when you're flexed, when the ulna moves up, guess where this coronoid process goes? It goes into the coronoid fossa. And when you're extended, the olecranon process fits into the fossa on the posterior side of the humerus, which is what? The olecranon fossa. Okay, so I think you should be able to see those pretty nicely in lab. All right, so now we're moving down into the hand, and got to pay just a little bit of attention to the hand. It's not too difficult, but students get it wrong all the time for some reason. All right, in this class, you will notice that there are 8 carpal bones. So what part of your anatomy do the carpal bones make up? They actually make up your wrist, right, in particular. So don't say hand, say your wrist. And I'm not going to ask you to name the carpal bones. There's only 8 of them, all right? But it's easy because there's a top row, superior row, and an inferior row. But I will say something about this little one right here, and that's the scaphoid, because clinically that's important. Notice how thin it is, especially in this region over here and over here. This is the one that when somebody breaks their wrist, most of the time this is the one that fractures. Okay, because it is so thin. So it's the scaphoid, so you should at least know that. And the other thing that you should know is that there is an artery that flows into the scaphoid, and when the scaphoid fractures, that artery is damaged and doesn't heal very well. And in order for a bone to heal, what does it need? It needs blood. It needs oxygen and nutrients. But if that vascular supply is disrupted, then the scaphoid has a tendency never to grow back the way it was. So once that bone is broken, people usually have a deficit pretty much for the rest of their lives because the scaphoid doesn't regenerate. As a matter of fact, sometimes, depending on the damage, it might be almost resorbed completely. All right, so that's the interesting thing about the scaphoid right here. So these, all 8 of these bones, now you will have to know that they're called carpals. So carpals make up the wrist, and the one you're interested in is the scaphoid because clinically it's relevant. All right, now we see some other more distal bones, and these bones right here make up the bone. Okay, they make up the bone. Somebody said bone. Yeah, they are bones. They make up the hand, the palm of the hand. Okay, so if the bones that make up the wrist are carpals, these are what we call metacarpals. Guess how many you have? You've got 5 of them, right? Okay, there's not much anatomic variation in the number of fingers that you have. Anatomically, what do we call a finger? It's called a digit. So a finger is a digit. You got 5 digits. Not all animals have 5 digits. Cats, I think, have 4 in their hind limbs, 5 in their front limbs. Okay, but humans have got what? 5 and 5 digits on their superior inferior limbs, upper appendage, lower appendage. And they're not really given names. They're given numbers. Number 1 all the way to 5. And number 1 starts with your thumb. Okay, so I don't know how to remember that. All right, just always start with your thumb. Some people count backwards from their little finger. Don't do that in lab. All right, so the number 1, metacarpal. Number 2, metacarpal. Okay, all the way over. That makes your hand. And now we have the digits. So here we have 5 digits. They're numbered the same way. So digit number 1 is your thumb, that's right. And your little finger is digit number 5, right? All right, your digits are made up of, most digits are made up of 3 long bones. All right, so here's a digit. Here is the proximal number. Which digit is this? Proximal number 4. Number 4. Here is middle number 4. And here is distal number 4. Okay, and these bones are what we call each one is a phalanx. Yeah, so all of these are phalanges. That's the plural term. So here is, okay, let's go talk about this one here. This is number 3, distal Phalanx. So that's how we talk about all these things. So somehow you just got to get the nomenclature straight in your mind. But as long as you don't freak out, I think it's easy to remember these. Yeah.
So digits and digits, okay?
You know what? A digit, for instance, this number 3-digit right here has 3 phalanges in it. So phalanges is one bone, but a digit is all of them put together, but not the metacarpal right here, because that makes your hand. Okay, the one exception to this is that the digit number 1, or your thumb, only has 2 phalanges. There's a proximal and a distal. There's no middle. All right, and it's going to be nice because you're going to see that your lower appendage follows the same nomenclature and basically the same architecture. So we changed the names a little bit so we know that we're talking about a hand versus a foot. Okay, so that's the hand. Make sure in lab you should be able to tell the difference between a foot and a hand, even with your eyes closed. Mm-hmm. All right, so that happens. Some students get that mixed up sometimes. All right, so don't let that happen to you. Make sure it's easy to tell, right? Just you have to look at it probably just one time. Okay. Now we're going to go from your upper appendage to lower appendage, and again, there are bones that hold your lower appendage to your axial skeleton. What do we call that, generally speaking? That's a girdle, and in particular that, since it's on your lower appendage, we call that the pelvic girdle. And here are some bones that make up the pelvic girdle. It's an oscoccyx, so you got a right and left oscoccyx right here. Now this is a sacrum and coccyx. Are these part of the girdle, or are these part of the appendicular skeleton? No, they're part of the axial skeleton. They're part of your vertebral column. We just put them in this diagram to have it make some sense, right? Okay, so don't forget, sacrum and coccyx are part of your axial skeleton, and the oscoccyx starts right here at the iliosacral joint. This is part of the oscoccyx we call the ilium, so this is the iliosacral joint right here, and you should remember there are auricular surfaces in this location on both the sacrum and the ilium of the oscoccyx. All right, and just like the scapula, when you pick this bone up in lab, I don't know if you'll be able to do this during a practicum, but make sure you pick it up and turn it around. Make sure you find the superior part of the bone, the inferior part, the anterior, posterior, and put it on your body to see how it fits. And then I think you can have a good picture of what this isolated bone looks like all by itself. So the inferior part is going to be this ischial process right here, because you can see this bone is the ischium, and the superior part is going to be the iliac crest right here. So it's easy to tell superior and inferior. And the next place you want to look for is something that you know that's easy to find, that's always going to be lateral, no matter what. And that's going to be a big fossa, big depression that's going to accept the head of the femur. All right, and we call that the acetabulum. So here's an acetabulum, here's an acetabulum that's lateral. So with those three pieces of information, okay, you should be able to then see what the anterior part of the oscoccyx is and the posterior part up over here. All right, but make sure you turn it around and model it on yourself and go look at it on the skeleton to see how it really fits. All right, so the oscoccyx, do I have a disarticulated one? Yes, is right here. The oscoccyx is really made up of 3 different bones that have fused together. And the superior one is the ilium, nicely color-coded in yellow. And then we have 2 inferior ones. The posterior one is the ischium, and that looks purple to me. Okay. And then the pubis, which kind of looks red to me, that's the anterior bone. All right. And so if you ever find a real oscoccyx, not just a plastic model, you can see the lines of fusion within the acetabulum. So you might want to just look at a nice pelvic bone. If it's a real bone, you might be able to see these lines of fusion right here where they meet up right within the acetabulum. Okay. Now what we can't do in lecture very well is turn this bone around 3-dimensionally. We need to get some holograms in here. But you know, what side of the bone is this? Lateral. And this is going to be the medial view, because here's that auricular surface that's going to articulate with the sacrum, for instance. All right. Now, what we want to be able to tell, since this is a nice lateral view looking from the side is what is the anterior and which is the posterior side of this bone. And I can see it. I'm not sure, unless you spend a lot of time in lab, that you can see it. But remember, the pubic bone is what? Anterior. That's so here's the anterior, and the ischium is posterior. So let's start with the anterior side of this bone. We see some spines sticking off. And this one right here, for sure, is anterior, right? And it's on the ilium, so it's an iliac spine. But there are actually two spines that are on the anterior side of the ilium. So this is what? The anterior superior iliac spine. Here's the anterior inferior iliac spine. Guess what the function of these spines are? They're rough, raised areas on a bone. Muscle attachment. Don't be tricked on a test. Just say muscle attachment. Okay. All right. Let's go to the posterior side. So let's move over the iliac crest over here, and you can see the ala, this big bony prominence, this fan of the ilium. Okay, that is what? On the outside or lateral aspect of the ilium, we see a couple more spines. There's one here. This is the now on the posterior side, posterior superior iliac spine, and then the posterior inferior iliac spine. And then we have a big indentation. This is a passageway for, guess what? Like maybe the sciatic nerve or something, some muscles going right through here. So this is the greater sciatic notch. There's also a lesser sciatic notch over here. And separating the sciatic notches are this process on the ischium. So this bone is the ischium. It's no longer the ilium. And so we call this the ischial spine. So what part of the ascoxa is the ischial spine on? It's on the posterior part. It's on the ischium, but it's the posterior. Right? So that's a nice landmark for you to kind of double check to make sure you know what is anterior and posterior on the ascoxa. All right, so don't call this one right here. Some students would maybe like to call this the posterior inferior iliac spine. But it's not, because it's not on the ilium, right? It's on the ischium. And it's a lot more prominent than the posterior inferior iliac spine. So I'm sure that's on your list to know. All right, this part right here, well, you know what? Since this is a posterior part, but it's also the most inferior, namely the ischium, so when you're sitting down, this is the bone that all of your body weight is resting on. And it's compressing all of this tissue. Not much tissue right there, right? But there is some tissue. And when you compress tissue, that cuts off the blood supply to it. And any kind of tissue with blood that's cut off, we say, is ischemic. Okay? And not necessarily dead, which is good, because we'd get up and start walking around and, all right, our buttocks aren't dead. They've just been ischemic for a while.
It's just a lack of oxygen.
So it's lack of oxygen because those blood vessels are compressed. Now, if you cut off oxygen for a long enough period of time for some tissues, it can die. And that's what we call necrosis. So ischemia is different than necrosis. Ischemia comes first, and then after a long period of time, it dies and becomes necrotic. Okay. So these muscles in your legs can become ischemic for quite a long time before they die, unlike your what? Your brain. That's right. You cut off blood supply to your brain. When is it going to die? When is it going to go from ischemia to necrotic tissue? Yeah, 3 to 4 minutes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because, well, there are nerves too. And if you compress a nerve, that can form a nerve block as well. But so if you it's really hard to say, probably a combination of both effects, compressing the nerve and cutting off oxygen to it too. Because it needs ATP to conduct electrical impulses through that point. But if there is no oxygen, that cell can't make ATP and it will have you'll have a sensory and you could have a motor deficit as well. Right? Yeah. Yeah, you got to move your body to keep that circulation going, right? If you hold a joint just in a certain way, you could cut off circulation. You could also impinge a nerve and put a nerve block at that location in your body.
By not moving it,
yeah. So I suppose if you don't want to wake up in the morning with like a funny feeling in your body anywhere, how should you sleep? in anatomic position, like on your back. Okay, that your joints are all aligned properly, but I don't know anybody that can do that unless they're on diazepam or something. Okay. So I'm sure we've all woken up and for some reason in the night we put our body in a really strange position and that joint is just messed up for a while and those muscles, hopefully just a short period of time. Okay, so the ascoxae, probably one of the more complicated bones, but you got to just model it on yourself to see how it all fits. Okay, so let's look at the pelvis. So the pelvis is, if we put a couple of these ascoxae together with the sacrum, we can see that the pelvic inlet is from above the pelvic bones, right, down into, okay, this foramen right here. The pelvic outlet is what? Going the opposite way. And the true pelvis is from, okay, what we call the pelvic brim, from this arcuate line right here. This is the true pelvis. So pelvic organs are going to be below this line. The false pelvis sometimes is an imaginary plane from the top of the ilium, the iliac crest, all the way down to the pubic bone right here. And some of you might have noticed that the male and female pelvis is different. So let's talk about maybe some, at least one way. And it's really easy to see. And if I had these male and female pelvis, even people in the back row could tell just like that. The easiest way to tell is by looking at this approximation, right, of the pubic bones. We call this the pubic arch. And in males, this pubic arch is going to be 90 degrees or less. And in females, guess what? The pubic arch is wider than 90 degrees. Could not 180 degrees, but greater than 90 degrees, maybe 120. Okay? For some reason I wanted to say 180, but that's not right. Greater than 90 degrees. All right, so what does that do? That enlarges the pelvic outlet for parturition. Okay. Something else. Here we have the pubic symphysis. That's fibrocartilage. I think we learned that that's an area where we have fibrocartilage. And, of course, during parturition, what happens to this joint? Right? It dissolves away, and that allows the pubic bones to separate and to angulate. That promotes the delivery of the child through the birth canal. And then what? After birth, it goes back together, more or less. Okay. It fuses back together, but probably never exactly the way it was, right? Or if you're a guy, this pubic symphysis can separate. Did I mention this in class before? Like if you're in a motorcycle accident and you go through the handlebars, these things, that separates. And guess what? It doesn't go back together exactly the way it was either. Okay. All right, what we can't see, maybe I can see it on this diagram right here. Okay, if we look at the pelvic outlet, another way you can tell from a lateral view is that in the male, the coccyx, and I can't tell if this is male or female, but I'll just tell you that in the male, the coccyx is going to angulate more anteriorly, but in the female, the coccyx is going to be what? More straight up and down, and again, just enlarging the pelvic outlet for parturition. That's another easy way to tell on a real pelvic bone. Oh, you know what? I got to go back to the hand for just a second, because I forgot to mention these little bones right here. And these are sesamoid bones. What kind of bone is a sesamoid bone? It's a bone that is found in where? It's found completely within a tendon. We learn different kinds of bones. Sesamoid is one kind. We learn what? Long and irregular, flat. Sesamoid is one kind.
So like the patella, the sesamoid?
And exactly, that's what reminded me to show you these. Yeah. So these are normal positions. They help stabilize the joints. And here's a patella. We don't find the patella up here by the hip. It should be where?
Knee.
Down over here in the knee. And so there is a important tendon that is attaching muscles from the anterior thigh as they move into the leg. And this patella is within that tendon. So the patella is what kind of bone? It's a sesamoid bone. Right. Sesamoid. All right, so make sure you look at it, see what it has. A patellar surface, it's got a pointy end, we call it the apex. All right, well, let's get back to the femur. Here's the proximal epiphysis, distal epiphysis. Here is the head, and here is the neck, that depression between the head and some big bony prominences for muscle attachment. These we don't call tubercles like we do with the humerus because these are more massive. They're holding much more body weight. We call these trochanters, the greater and lesser trochanter. And here's an intertrochanteric line. On the anterior side, here's the intertrochanteric crest on the posterior side that's connecting these. So there's muscle attachments along all of these different areas. And here is the neck. And unfortunately, that's a place where fractures can occur. Okay, so there is no surgical neck on the femur. But there is something interesting right here. There's a little pit in the head of the femur right here that we call the fovea capitis. And this is where a ligament goes between the head of the femur and where does this head of the femur articulate? The acetabulum. So there's a ligament that goes between the head of the femur and the acetabulum. There's also an artery that follows that same material. And a lot of times, trauma to the hip can damage that ligament and can damage that artery. And guess what happens to the head of the femur when that artery is damaged and maybe it's destroyed altogether? Because it's bringing what? Oxygen and nutrients to the head of the femur. So what happens first? It becomes ischemic. And then if that blood supply isn't reestablished, it becomes necrotic. And then it just dissolves away. So people are going to be just missing this whole head of the femur right here. Well, that's miserable because then you have this big stump without articular cartilage rubbing up against the acetabulum. That's very miserable. There's no way you could even walk. And so when that happens, what does that person need? A hip replacement. And that's sort of interesting because there was one professional athlete who was such a tremendous athlete. He played both baseball and football professionally. And when he was playing football, we think he got tackled in the hip and it damaged that artery, and he had to have a hip replacement because of what, necrosis of the head of the femur right here. So they replaced his hip, but he was still such a fantastic athlete that he went back and played professional baseball. He was smart enough not to go back and play baseball, but he went back and, I mean, play football, but he went back and played baseball. Anybody know who that was?
Bo Jackson.
Yeah, it was Bo Jackson. Amazing that somebody with an artificial hip, which is so important, that he could actually still go back and play. Okay, so now you know a little bit about that fovea capitis. And so bone necrosis, is that a dangerous condition? Is that a really unfortunate condition? Yes, and it can happen to some people without trauma, and then they have to replace joints and things of that nature. Okay, so if you want to do a Google on bone necrosis to find what kind of people are susceptible to bone necrosis. Right, there's a certain body habitus that's prone to that. It was probably family history as well. Okay, so here's a diaphysis. On the posterior diaphysis, we have this nice long process that's rough. Let's call that the linea aspera. Guess what the function of the linea aspera is? Muscle attachment. But it's just what? A long, narrow process, but it's still nonetheless rough. We have the condylar surface, right? So we got the medial condyle, lateral condyle, and then where they attach anteriorly is the patellar surface because there is an articulation between the patella and these condyles. And, of course, the medial and lateral epicondyles right here. And you can always tell which one is medial and lateral by the head of the femur right here. So you should always be able to figure that out. Here is the intercondylar notch. And right here is the intercondylar fossa. So notch and fossa. So that's pretty much it for the femur. I maybe talked a little bit too long about the femur, but anyway, that was fun. All right, so here we are in the, where is this? What part of your body is this? That's your leg. And as a matter of fact, what part of your body is this? That's your thigh. Yeah, make sure you have that nomenclature correct, thigh versus leg. So in your leg, just like in your forearm, there are two bones. There's a medial and a lateral. The medial one is the tibia and the lateral one is the fibula. And during the test, you could probably palpate your leg and feel which one is which. You can't really feel the fibula because there's too much muscle around it. But you can feel your shin, and you can feel that medial bone very easily. That's the tibia. So the shin, right, is the anterior border on the tibia. Tibial crest, maybe. I don't know. You have to look at your notes. Tibial crest. Okay, the condylar surfaces on the tibia that articulate with the medial and lateral condyles of the femur are here and here, and there's an eminence between the two condyles. And this eminence right here, oh, here's another example. This is a process, we call it the intercondylar eminence. Find it in lab. Here's another exception to that rule. It's not there for muscle attachment. There are no muscles that attach there, but there nonetheless are still very strong and important ligaments that stabilize the knee. So remember, a ligament and a tendon are sort of the same kind of thing. One's for muscle, one's for a bone-to-bone connection. So that process is for a ligament in particular, and I'll tell you when we get to it in joints, that would be for the cruciate ligaments. Anybody ever hear of a cruciate ligament before? Probably. Okay, that's where the anterior and posterior cruciate ligaments insert into the head of the tibia. Okay, these bony prominences down over here, which make your ankle bone, these are what we call the malleoli. And one is a malleolus. Here's the medial malleolus on the tibia. Here's the lateral malleolus on the fibula. And there is a nice rough raised bony prominence on the proximal epiphysis of the anterior tibia right here. We call that the tibial tuberosity. So what's the function of this tibial tuberosity? Muscle attachment. And it's going to be attached by a ligament that goes to the patella, and then the patella, there's going to be a tendon that goes from the patella to the quadriceps when we get the muscles. So essentially the quadriceps, the muscles of your anterior thigh, insert into the tibial tuberosity. Okay, that's the tibia and fibula. And here you have a hand. No. Good. There's still some people awake. That's fantastic. All right, this is a foot. So here we're looking at just a superior view of the foot. And just like the bones that make up the wrist, those are? These of the wrist are what we call carpals. All right, you have bones that make up the ankle. We can't call those carpals. They're close. They're called tarsals. Okay, and I'm not going to ask you to know all the tarsals, but you got to know two. You got to know the one that articulates with the tibia and fibula. So let's go back and look at the tibia and fibula. See this little notch right here that's formed by the medial and lateral malleoli? Okay, the bone that fits up in here is the talus. So that's the most superior part of the ankle. So here we see the talus right here. Okay, so this is what we call the trochlea of the talus. I don't think you have to know that. This structure right here is called the dome of the talus. And has anybody ever sprained an ankle in here? Very common injury, okay, because there's so much weight that's borne by this particular joint. So all these injuries to these bones and ligaments that go across these joints are fairly common. Okay, so we got the talus, and then just below the talus is the calcaneus that makes up your heel, the calcaneus. So when you strike your heel on the ground, what's the name of the bone that you're striking on the ground? That's that calcaneus, right? So all of these other bones are tarsals all the way up to here. Now, bones of the foot per se, not the ankle joint, these are what we call meta-something, metatarsals, not metacarpals, because where do you have metacarpals? In your hand. All right, so these are metatarsals. So this one right here, which number is this? Number one, that's your big toe. And here's number two, number three, number four, number five, metatarsal. And then here are your digits of your foot, right? And most of them have three phalanges, again, a proximal, middle, and distal. So tell me this one, classify that one right there. That would be, I would say it's middle number three phalanx. Okay, oh yeah, phalanx. That would classify. Because where's the proximal? Here's the proximal, because here's metatarsal, number three. Number three, proximal. Number three, middle phalanx. Middle three, distal phalanx. But in the big toe, you only got proximal and distal, number one phalanx. Yeah. I don't know if it's always. I would say there's probably enough anatomic variation. You know, I just don't know. I could ask, if I talk to a podiatrist friend of mine, I'll ask him. But you know, our feet are deformed so much because a lot of us wear what all the time? Shoes. And we, you know, that kind of deforms what the natural form of the foot is. So I don't really know. And then if you're athletic, I don't know what happens to the shape of those toes, if the muscles expand them a little bit, or maybe if you put your feet into tight shoes, it kind of compresses them a little bit. I'm not really sure. So there's probably enough anatomic variation to maybe not even say what the rule is. Why, do you have like a really long number two?
No.
No. Just kidding. Okay, so that's a little bit about the foot, but here is another good view of the foot, lateral and medial view. And again, you can see the tarsals in this region right here making up the ankle. So here's calcaneus and the talus right here. All right, then the metatarsals and then the phalanges. And so you got to know that. What about arches? Oh, yeah, we got some arches in the foot. Okay. And I think you should know that these arches of the foot just help distribute weight and promote balance and coordination in our gait, in our walking. Okay, so these arches are normal, and that helps distribute weight when we put all of our weight on one foot as we're walking. Yeah.
In plantar fasciitis, is it the arches that are?
There are. Okay, there's fascia. Fascia, in this particular case, you could consider it like an aponeurosis, and maybe we didn't get the aponeurosis yet, but it's a broad, flat tendonous sheath, okay? And that can become inflamed. So it's a broad, flat tendonous sheath at the bottom of your foot over here, but attached to all of these bones are muscles of your leg, your posterior leg and anterior leg, right? Well, for some reason, there's too much tension in all of these muscles in your leg that are pulling on this tendonous sheath at the bottom of your foot. And one way to help resolve that situation is to work on the muscles of your leg, right? To stretch them out properly, not to radically stretch them, because that would put more tension on this broad, flat tendonous sheath right here. But gently stretching them and proper stretching exercises typically helps plantar fasciitis. And if it's really bad, I don't know, they might treat it with cortisone or something, injection.
Orthotics.
But, huh? And orthotics, and sometimes, you know, it might be because the arches aren't just proper in your foot, maybe because of the shoes that you're wearing, might be a congenital minor malformation. All right, so arches sometimes will help that, but probably the thing that will help that most is wearing the proper kind of shoes and doing the proper kind of exercise. I don't know if there's usually any kind of surgical intervention for that or not. But for a lot of different joints, there are surgical interventions. But I would always, in my personal life, I've always found that the proper exercise has always helped me a lot more than surgical intervention. Yeah. Oh, say it just a little bit louder. Oh, a digit and a phalange. No, they're different. Different conceptions. So if I show you this right here, okay, this is a digit. What digit is it? Number two. Okay, it's digit number two. And in this digit, how many bones do I have? I have three what? Phalanges. So phalanges are the bones that make up a digit. Okay, so digit number two through five have three phalanges. Digit number one has only two phalanges. So yeah, there kind of is an important distinction between phalanges and digit. Yeah? Okay. How many phalanges? Two. In one? One digit, my thumb. Right. Okay. Okay, and guess what? We got done a little early. Now I feel bad about that. You want to do a flash quiz again before we go? Okay, let's see if I can boot it up. Where is it? Skull bones. Should we do it really fast or just kind of like medium pace first? Fast. Okay. Whoa, that was too fast. Okay, but I saw one bone. What bone did I see? Sphenoid. Parietal. Temporal. Mandible. Occipital. Lacrimal. Ethmoid. Palatine. Zygomatic. Inferior nasal concha. Nasal bone. Maxilla. Vomer. Hyoid. Frontal. Sphenoid. Okay, let me just throw out a couple of questions. What bones have paranasal sinuses? Ethmoid, sphenoid, frontal, and maxilla. Yeah, maxilla. Okay. Oh, I got to enable the answer keys to the homework. I'll do that tonight. If you don't see it by tomorrow, somebody send me an email, but I'll enable the answer keys for homework. What else? How many cervical vertebrae are there?
Seven.
How many thoracic? How many pairs of ribs do you have? Is there a coincidence there, or is that what? No coincidence, right? You got to have the exact number of vertebrae that you have pairs of ribs, because that's where they attach. How many lumbar?
Five.
What is one distinguishing feature of a cervical vertebrae that no other vertebrae has? Bifid spinous process and transverse foramina. What about thoracic vertebrae? Costal facets, that's right. On the body, there are facets for the head of the rib, and on the transverse processes, there are facets for the tubercle of ribs. Yeah.
Number seven.
Vertebral prominence. Because if you put your hand on the back of your head and slide down your spinal cord, cervical spine, you're going to come to a bump. And that bump should be there. That's due to C7, the cervical prominence. Okay, so that's always there in everybody. Okay, what else? What's the name of the joint, the only joint that holds your upper appendage to your axial skeleton? Manubrioclavicular joint right here. What's the only joint that's holding your whole lower appendage to your axial skeleton? The sacroiliac joint. Actually, it's back here. Sacroiliac joint. Okay, that's between the auricular surfaces of the sacrum and the, ilium, which is part of, what's a massive bone that's formed, part of it being the ilium? The ascoxae. What are the three bones that make up the ascoxae? Ilium, ischium, and pubis in the front. Okay, those are all pretty good questions. What bone is medial in the forearm? The ulna. What bone is medial in the leg?
Tibia.
Yeah, so the fibula is lateral. You're going to have to look at that a lot of times. That's probably some of the hardest things to memorize, but you can maybe figure it out during the test. Let's see. What else? What bone usually breaks in your wrist due to trauma?
Scaphoid.
And generally, what bone does that belong to? What the name of that cluster of bones? Those are carpals, right? And, all right, I don't know. See if you can stump me. Think of a good question. What bone has a dens? C2. Or axis, that's right. What's the name of the bone that articulates with the occipital bone?
Atlas.
Yeah, in terms of vertebral column, that's the atlas. Okay, what's another bone that articulates with occipital bone? The parietal bones, yeah, in the that form the cranium or the cranial vault. Okay. In the elbow, the distal humerus has two condyles, two articulating surfaces that are smooth. Can you name the lateral one? That's the capitulum, right? And what does it articulate with, the lateral one? The radius, because the radius is lateral. Now, what about the condyle that's medial in the humerus? That's the trochlea, and it articulates with the ulna for sure, but what part of the ulna? The trochlea articulates with what on the ulna? It's really easy once you see it. It's the trochlear notch. It's the notch in the ulna. We call that the trochlear notch. All right, so again, the way we name parts of bones, depending on what they articulate with. So there is a notch. Let's see if I can figure this out. There is a notch in the proximal ulna that articulates with the head of the radius. So it's in the ulna, okay, that articulates with the head of the radius. What is this little notch called? It's the radial notch, okay? And then way down at the distal part of the radius, there is a notch that articulates with the head of the ulna. What's that name of that notch? That's the ulnar notch of the radius. All right, so sometimes there's a lot of nice symmetry you can use to help you memorize stuff. Yeah?
Obturator foramen.
Obturator, let me see. Ah, that's in the ascoxae. You know, it's kind of covered by a really strong membrane. And I don't think you got much going through the obturator foramen. Was that a test question, a quiz question in lab? Yeah, you know, officially, I don't think there's much going through there. You might have some minor nerves and blood vessels. Say that again.
Femoral artery.
I'm going to have to review my cross-sectional anatomy to see what goes. You know, I suspect that not much goes through there. It's a nice membrane that kind of covers that. Now the femoral. Are there some nerves? Might be a femoral nerve that goes through there. I'll get back to you.
They do have to know.
Did you have to know that in lab or something? What goes through there? Ah. Okay, you got to know the foramen though, and the function of that foramen is passageway. So I guess you would guess that something goes through there. Okay. Wikipedia or Google is the first thing I'm going to do after class. Yeah.
When joints are named, is there any particular order?
When joints are named?
Yeah, when you name a joint, like which one goes first?
Usually from proximal to distal, or maybe superior to inferior. Like the glenohumeral joint, the sacroiliac joint, manubrioclavicular joint, that's from proximal to distal. Yeah.
I'm having a difficult time.
Okay.